Welcome to a new series of Animal People. I'm Sarah Lestrange. The show is about the complex relationship between humans and animals. Even if you're not into animals, in a way, we are all animal people. We eat them, experiment on them, we share the planet with them, and we're animals, people. Today, animal therapy, using animals as therapy for humans and treating mental illness in animals. Lots of people think it's indulgent to medicate pets, but is it so strange? Animals have feelings too, don't they? American science historian Laurel Breitman was forced to consider the issue of animal mental illness when her Bernese mountain dog, Oliver, developed some very destructive behaviours.
One day we left him alone for about 3 hours and he had a panic attack and he pushed our window air conditioning unit out of the way and he chewed a hole through the metal window screen on our window and somehow held up the sash of the window and then jumped out. And it wouldn't have been a big deal except that we lived on the third floor of an apartment building. And so he fell 3 stories into the cement well of the basement apartment. And miraculously, he survived. But I had to then figure out how to deal with him.
What did you do to try to help Oliver?
The first thing that we did was, you know, pick him up at the vet clinic after his stay. And I was obviously really upset and asked the attending veterinarian what we should do. And, he looked at me and he said, move to a first floor apartment. And then he wrote us a prescription for Valium and for Prozac and, you know, wrote it for the dog. At that point, I've always been someone who believed other animals could have emotions, but I definitely wouldn't have told you before Oliver that I would have had a dog that I would have put on Prozac for his emotional distress or given him Valium to help with his fear of thunderstorms. That was something, you know, I thought was just a shade too anthropomorphic. And I thought, you know, dogs are dogs and, you know, they need exercise and a good diet and time with other animals. And I really thought that was the kind of thing that could fix everything. And then I was just so incredibly humbled by my experience with this dog.
And I guess this idea of giving Prozac to animals, for instance, or Valium, that too can be laughed at. We're treating animals the way we treat humans. But it's not that unreasonable when you think about how these medications were developed, is it?
No. In fact, you know, these really are animal drugs. When we're taking our antipsychotic medications or our anti-anxiety medications or our antidepressants, we're taking drugs that were, you know, tested in other animals and not for toxicity. They were obviously tested for other animals for toxicity, but they were also tested for behavioral effects. So the whole reason, you know, that we got these drugs was that they relaxed cats and rats and mice and primates in the lab. You know, help them do tasks differently and everything else. And I don't think the drug should be used as a first line of response, but they can be really, really helpful. You know, they just shouldn't be used just as in humans as a Band-Aid without the underlying issues of, say, anxiety or mood disorders being addressed.
Jenny.
Hello.
Hi, Sarah.
Nice to meet you, Sarah.
Nice to meet you.
I wonder you didn't get
I'm visiting the home of Jenny, one of her 2 dogs, which are Beagle ears, Beagle Cavalier crosses, is a big barker. Jenny resorted to the expertise of a veterinary behaviourist, a psychiatrist for pets, because Georgie will bark at anything.
Leaves, possums, birds, cats, anything, anything. She's hyperactive and she's on alert the whole time.
They're both climbing up onto my lap to have a bit of a pat.
Good girl. We tried some medication last year, some Valium, that had no effect whatsoever. And then this time we thought we'd go to an animal behaviourist, which we started off at the RSPCA, and we filled out all the forms. We sat down with her, and before she sort of commenced chatting to us, she said, you need to see a vet behaviourist after reading the list of the problems that we had with Georgie. So that was very telling that we had to continue on.
So you did try a number of avenues. I would like to know, though, for that first time you gave your dog Georgie Valium, and this was from your local vet, did you feel a bit strange doing that?
In a way, yes, but then we were quite desperate, so we wanted to really get something beneficial for her and for us and everyone else in the neighbourhood as well. So we were open to any suggestion, and unfortunately the Valium didn't work. But I think now this new medication is certainly having a really positive effect.
So you decided to go and see a vet behavioralist.
Yes. Her conclusion at the end was, yes, Georgie does have an anxiety disorder and it does need medication. So we've basically been on the medication for 3 weeks, so we're early into the medication, but the whole sort of package is medication and behaviour modification and writing diaries. So we've still got a lot to go through, but we're on a positive path. Georgie, sit. Georgie, sit. Oh, well done. Well done.
Jenny took her dog Georgie to see Dr. Jackie Lee.
I'm a veterinary behaviourist, which means that I am like a psychiatrist and a psychologist, but for animals who have trouble with living in the world where we put them. So we're currently at the clinic where I see animals with behaviour problems. Of course, you know, horses we would see out in paddock, but dogs and cats and birds we bring into the veterinary clinic.
So if someone brings in their pet, say a dog, how do you diagnose what's going on? They can't tell you.
Well, actually, the animals do say an awful lot. The thing is that they say it with their bodies. So I spend a lot of time speaking with the owners. We work through quite a detailed history to get an idea of how the owners live and manage their pet. We also look very specifically at the behaviour. While I'm speaking with the clients, the animal is just here in the room with us, and I'm watching how it responds to being somewhere that's a little bit different, how it asks and how often it asks for attention from the owner. So I'm actually looking at very subtle behaviours, the same way that a psychiatrist and a psychologist, they're watching as much the body language of their clients as much as what the client is actually saying.
All right, well, you suggest that the animal has an anxiety disorder. How do you treat it?
So treating anxiety disorders, we do follow a same sort of pattern as we would if we were treating diabetes. So there are things that we do with every patient. So we will ask the owners to perhaps look at how they manage their pet to minimise stress and minimise triggers. We would work on specific exercises geared towards helping the animal relax and practice the behaviours that we want them to display. And in some cases, you know, where it's appropriate, we use medication. And we use that to help the animal be in a state where it can start to learn. Because if you're constantly worrying or you're panicking, which is often what's happening with these animals, your ability to learn that, say, garbage bins won't kill you is actually impaired. So we actually may have to bring this animal back, do some work with it, have it on medication, and then gradually introduce it to the idea that a garbage bin won't kill it. And that takes time. But our biggest goal is to have, you know, relaxed, calm, happy animals who have a good life, and owners who, you know, are able to enjoy having their pet.
I find that people in the general public, when they hear about this sort of intervention for pets, are quite dismissive and scoff at it and think that it's indulgent.
I've certainly been the brunt of a few dinner party jokes and things. For a lot of people, the closest they will get to an animal is their pet. They only have one Buffy, and if Buffy's not well, then we have to help with Buffy. And that goes for Buffy's mental health.
It's not just pets that are medicated with Prozac or Valium. Zoo animals are too. Gigi the gorilla, who lives in Franklin Park Zoo, Boston, had a psychiatrist who ended up treating the whole troop. Science historian Laurel Brateman tells the story in her book, Animal Madness: How Anxious Dogs, Compulsive Parrots, and Elephants in Recovery Help Us Understand Ourselves.
Gigi is a personal hero of mine. So Gigi is an older gorilla. She's a little bit particular. She's always been prone to anxiety. But after a young male arrived in the troop more than a decade ago, he really began to pick on her, and she didn't react well. in many ways, this caused a kind of spiraling anxiety disorder. And she wasn't able to stick up for herself. And the other females in the troop at that point didn't stick up for her much either. And the male really terrorized her. And she started to be unable to sleep at night. She would suffer from nightmares. She would shut down and shake and rock, try to soothe herself anytime she would see the male. And the keeper staff began to get really worried, and they were convinced that they were seeing in her something like an anxiety disorder or a mood disorder. They weren't really sure. And nothing that they did helped. And they were on, I really admire the keepers at the Franklin Park Zoo. They were on these 24-hour shifts where they were sleeping in cots next to the gorilla exhibit so that she wouldn't feel alone, because she was calmed by the presence of the keepers. But they couldn't keep doing that. And so in desperation, the veterinarian there called a human psychiatrist in. And because it was Boston, she called a psychiatrist from Harvard Medical School, a man named Michael Muffson. And Dr. Muffson came into the zoo and took one look at Gigi and became convinced, you know, after his initial consult with her and then watching her in the troop for a few days, that she had a mood disorder and that she also was suffering from a form of post-traumatic stress. And he started her on a series of antidepressants and anti-anxiety medications, but those didn't really work. And so he just really began to agitate for a change in her living situation and to take her away from that male so that she could feel safe and begin to reconnect with the other girls in the troop who were less threatening to her. And it worked. And she's become a lot more confident. It's really an amazing thing to see.
So how new is this idea to think about animals as experiencing emotions, having mental illness?
Well, it's really not new at all, actually. One of the things I spent a lot of time doing while researching the book was trying to find out if other people had thought this throughout history. And what I discovered was that, yes, you know, a lot of Victorians actually spent a lot of time wondering about mental illness, or what they called insanity and hysteria and melancholy and many other emotional ailments in non-human animals. And it turns out that as you look at the history of how we've made sense of mental health in people, every time there's been a kind of human mental illness epidemic, things like hysteria or mortal nostalgia or mortal heartbreak, there's been an accompanying rash of cases in other animals. And these things were reported in the newspapers, you know, side by side, human cases and animal cases.
Well, ascribing emotions to animals, this idea is challenging still for many people. It's this sticky term of anthropomorphism which gets us all stuck, doesn't it? Because we're trained to think that anthropomorphism is a bad thing for animals, dressing them up in clothes and ascribing human desires like getting married to them. But for you, anthropomorphism, you actually say we need to embrace it.
Yes. I mean, I try not to dress my dog up in clothes. The truth is I did put him in a cape once for a dog parade.
I put my guinea pigs in clothes when I was a 12-year-old.
I would really love to see a photo of that. Yeah, my dog didn't seem to mind the cape for too long, although I made sure he got some peanut butter enticements. You know, that said, I do think there are damaging forms of anthropomorphism, assuming without being really curious that you know exactly what your animal needs and wants, you know, is an example of that, bending them to your will. The thing is, though, is that we can't really not anthropomorphize. It's not like you can take your brain out of your head and put it in a jar and then use it to think about another animal's experience or thoughts or feelings. We will always be projecting onto other animals. And I think the question is really, how do you project well? We can never truly get inside the mind of another animal, but I think that we can imagine it better. And that's what we need to do.
You're listening to Animal People on RN, opening your mind to the emotional lives of non-human animals. While animals sometimes need our help to adjust to life in the big wide world, sometimes they can help us too. When father of psychotherapy Sigmund Freud saw his patients, one of his trusty dogs, a chow called Yofi, was always by his side. Perhaps this is an early case of animal-assisted therapy.
It's actually defined as any time an animal is intentionally incorporated into some sort of intervention for a person. Could be with horses, with dogs, with cats, with guinea pigs, for children, for adults, there's a number of applications.
You know, dogs in nursing homes, horses and autistic children.
My name is Maggie O'Hare. I'm an assistant professor of human-animal interaction in the Center for Human-Animal Bond at Purdue University in the U.S. The principles vary based on the population that you're working with, but the idea behind it is that there's something unique about interacting with an animal that can positively influence the lives of humans. So generally, the most common things that people look for are things like influencing social interactions or reducing stress or anxiety. And those are the key things, and then it can be tailored to the specific needs of individuals.
It's a feel-good notion, isn't it? Of course animals will help people in times of crisis. But the research to prove this idea is thin on the ground. Maggie O'Hare has addressed this situation by doing her own study, a control trial of guinea pigs in a classroom to enhance the social inclusion of children with autism.
So I developed a classroom program with guinea pigs for schools that I ran throughout the greater Brisbane area, and I wanted to do a study that would kind of rectify some of the weaknesses in the prior literature. So the ways that I did that were I had a larger sample. I went to a bunch of schools around Brisbane. I also used lots of different measures. So a lot of the earlier studies are qualitative, and they simply ask people how they felt about the program. But I used standardized measures and physiological measures to assess the outcomes. And I also had a few different control conditions, because one of the criticisms of this research is maybe it's not the animal that helps. Maybe it's just having something new and fun and engaging there. So I wanted to definitely have a few conditions that were also fun and engaging, but weren't the animal, to see the differences.
What did you find?
So what I found was that through having the animal in the classroom, both teachers and parents reported that there were increased social skills among the children with autism, and actually also among the typically developing children in the classroom, compared to the time when the animals were not in the classroom. So that was my first finding. And then I also looked into, I wanted to videotape it and see, okay, when the animal's there, is it any different than when the animal's not there, or when they're with toys or doing another activity? And what I found was that when the animals are there, these children are engaging in more social behaviors. They're talking to their peers, they're smiling more, they're laughing more. There tends to be a more positive and engaged tone when the animal is there. And from that, I took it a step further because I thought, okay, this is what's happening on the outside, but what's going on underneath physiologically? And what I found then was that it turns out when the animal is there, the children with autism have lower arousal. And this is a population that has higher arousal, particularly in social situations. So the fact that an animal being there could reduce that arousal may be what's leading to these more positive social interactions. If you're not feeling so anxious and aroused, you might feel more open to interacting positively with your peers.
So in this case, animal-assisted therapy did help. But it doesn't mean you should discard your therapist or just get a pet. On a bleak day in Victoria, I've headed up the Hume Highway from Melbourne to Shepparton to a program that combines the principles of animal-assisted therapy with the idea that animals sometimes need therapy too.
My name's Colin Emmonson. We're here at Horses for Hope near Shepparton. Horses for Hope is a program where people come who have got some issues going on in their life to work with horses who have issues that are going on in their life. The people who come to the program work with us to help those horses through those problems, and at the same time, those people are being helped by the process as well. It's where horses and people come together to help each other.
It's flat country here, and there isn't much activity around the property except for the twittering birds. The horses are in their paddock, and soon one of them will be brought to the ring to show me how Horses for Hope works.
My name is Charlie Boyer. I'm in the program because I've had worry over the years.
Can you say what sort of things you were worried about?
My sister running away. Now I've gotten over that, and I used to have sleeping problems where I couldn't sleep, but now that's fixed because of Horses for Hope. It makes me feel calmer, and I feel relaxed when I'm in the yard with them.
What else do you feel? Do you feel a sense of achievement?
Yes. When I've made their head drop and they're licking and chewing.
What does that mean?
That they respect me and they trust me.
Does it also mean that you're helping them as well?
Yes.
Were you scared of them before you came here?
No.
What about when you first went in the yard with the horse? What did you feel?
Excited and not worried at all.
That's quite interesting, isn't it, when you're a worrier?
But when I got into the yard, I felt like there was no worry in the world.
Alison, this is Sarah.
Hi.
Hi, Alison. How are you going?
Good,
thanks. So, Alison, you're going in the ring with Charlie.
Yes, sir.
How do you feel, Charlie?
Not nervous at all.
Not nervous? Any excitement?
Yes.
How much excitement out of 10?
About 5.
5. So not too excited that the horse is going to react, but probably excitement to have fun.
Nodding.
Yes, that was a yes.
Can you describe what Fondalura looks like, Charlie?
She's like a brown with black hair, a white line on her head.
Fondalura's here is because she was a little bit disrespectful. And so she was pushing and shoving, and that when she actually shown the disrespect was because she didn't feel safe in her environment. So once she got the balance of trust and respect, she's actually really nice to be around.
Threading
towards the middle.
So what Charlie's doing is he's going in.
Can you describe what she's doing at the moment?
Yeah, she's running, she's gone in, she hasn't met Charlie for a long time. He's new to her, and so she's running in quite a strong way. He's in the middle of the yard with Alison, and in a sense, following her around the yard with his eyes, he's staying in the middle. And you just saw Fondalura kick out and say, "Get stuffed. This I'm in charge here." So now he's dropped his energy down, and he's got his hand out in front of him because the energy's down, and she's wanting to come off the fence to come closer to him. And she just licked and chewed. Did you see that? And she dropped her head. There we go. So he's changing his body stance. Do you see where that horse has gone to? That horse has gone to Charlie, not to Alison.
And now he's patting her head.
He's giving her a rub on the head. How are you feeling?
I'm very impressed.
It's an emotional thing. You're actually seeing a connection being made, and you can feel that from out here. Now he walks away. Look at Fondalura's doing. Going with him and licking and chewing. All right. Now I defy anybody to do that and not feel good about it. There's success right there. You've actually affected another being. Charlie's been cast in the role of a helper, not a helpee. If he can do this with a big horse, he can do it at home when worry comes along, and he does. And we've had lots of conversations about this. There's no magic in this. The magic is in what happens between the horse and the person, but that's not what does the healing. It helps, but the healing and the change comes from how that then the conversations I had about that and how the family is brought into those conversations.
How did you feel out there, Charlie?
I'm not nervous at all.
Did you feel confident?
Yes.
What do you think Fondalura would say about you?
Thank you very much.
About?
Training.
Yeah.
I'm a bit awestruck watching 11-year-old Charlie in control of that big horse. I was worried for him because he's so much smaller than the horse, which did not look happy to be there initially. I'm not sure I could do it. By paying closer attention to the emotional lives of animals, what can be learnt? Laurel Breitman concludes that what is good for them is good for us.
I mean it metaphorically and also very, very practically. So oftentimes what helps, you know, a dog or a parrot or an elephant or a bonobo who's dealing with anxiety or a phobia or a mood disorder is also what helps us. So it's things like maintaining a healthy diet, getting plenty of time outside. So I think that we have much to learn from them. And then on a sort of different scale, learning to empathize with another species, I think, exposes the most beautiful parts of being human. I am yet to see an example of, you know, another species that will set up a sanctuary to help another species. You know, this is something that our species does, and I think it's selfless and it is just so beautiful, and I think it makes us the best version of ourselves.
That's all from Animal People today. Next week, the unsettling territory of children raised by animals. The real-life stories are far more troubling than Tarzan and The Jungle Book. I'm Sarah Lestrange. Look forward to joining you then.